The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Salomon Rushdie's novels are known for their witty examinations of ever-changing socio-political landscape. Midnight's Children, winner of the prestigious Booker Prize, is a comedic telling of Indian history. Published in 2005, Shalimar the Clown is an epic narrative that moves from California to Kashmir, from Nazi-occupied Europe to the world of modern terrorism. In his latest novel, The Enchantress of Florence, a young European traveler arrives at the court of the great Mughal Empire with a story about a mysterious and beautiful woman, believed to possess the power of sorcery, and her impossible journey to the far-off city of Florence. We are thrilled to have him here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the newly knighted Salomon Rushdie.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, enough. Thank you. So I'm going to read you a bit from this book, the new one, and then we'll talk. And there's roving microphones, and as you've been told, please wait for the microphones, otherwise nobody will be able to hear anything. So The Enchantress of Florence, it's, as you heard a little bit of it, it's about this princess of the Mughal dynasty in India who gets mislaid. She gets captured by a rival warlord, and then he gets killed by the Shah of Persia, and then she decides she likes the Shah of Persia, so she stays with him until she doesn't. And she begins to move across the world, and in the end she falls in love with this young man who's not even young by the time she meets him, 45-year-old man, who's a soldier of fortune, and at the point that she meets him has been working as working in the army of the Ottoman Sultan, and they go back to Florence, and she creates lots of trouble, and she's probably a witch. It's what they were like those days. Witchy. The bit I wanted to read you is actually a passage set neither in India nor in Italy. It's actually the moment at which the two lovers come together and what happens then. And it happens actually on a battlefield. There was at the early 16th century, there was a kind of world-changing battle on the borders of Turkey and what was then Persia. It was called the Battle of Chaldiran, and it was the battle which, in a way, set the frontiers between those two countries that are still the frontiers between those countries. It was a battle between the Ottomans and the Safavid Empire in Persia. And one of the things that is characteristic of this book is that all the weirdest stuff in it is true. There's material relating to tulips, which you will notice. Some of it is, I'm sorry to say, a little obscene. They liked it a lot when I read it recently in the Ottawa Tulip Festival. So it passed the tulip experts. One of the things in this that was referred to that I should mention is, which is also true, is that when in the story she's imprisoned by this, I guess, Uzbek warlord who really existed, who was called Shaibani Khan, whose name means wormwood, so he was called Lord Wormwood. As I say, you can't make this stuff up. When he was defeated by the Shah of Persia, the Shah of Persia killed him, chopped him up into bits, sent bits of the body around the empire to prove that he was dead, took his skull, set it with gold and jewels, and made it into a wine goblet, and would drink from it in the evenings for a while, and then he had a better idea. and sent it as a present to the Sultan of Turkey, the Ottoman Sultan, as a gift, basically to say, this is what I just did to the guy I didn't like on my eastern frontier, and since you're the guy on my western frontier, I thought you might like to see it. And the Ottomans, as what's happened in this fashion, the Ottomans essentially said, oh yeah, and sent this colossal army to fight him, and the result of that was this battle. Now, of course, you may think that the goblet is a piece of magic realism, but it's not. That actually happened. So, as I say, when you listen to this, anything that strikes you as being excessively fantastic, you can be confident that that's true. And anything that seems realistic, I probably made up. All right. Argalia's for he's called Antonino Argalia, the Italian mercenary who's now the Janissary general. The Janissaries were like the marines of the Ottoman army. They were the most feared fighting force in the world of that time, and they were often composed of slaves and prisoners and people from other countries. And one of the interesting things about the Ottomans is that it was a kind of early meritocracy, that you could rise very, very quickly through the system. You could literally start as a slave boy and end up as a general if you showed any kind of aptitude. So they would promote people without any concern for their class origin or their family background or anything like that. So you could arrive as a destitute child and end up as a very powerful person. And that happened quite frequently. And it's what happened to him. Argalia's 45th birthday had come and gone. He was a tall, pale man, and in spite of the years of war, his skin was as white as a woman's. Men and women alike marveled at its softness. He was a lover of tulips, and had them embroidered onto his tunics and cloaks, believing them to be bringers of good fortune. And of the 1,500 varieties of Stamboul tulip, six in particular were to be found thronging his palace rooms. The light of paradise, the matchless pearl, the increaser of pleasure, the instiller of passion, the diamond's envy, and the rose of the dawn, these were his favorites. I should point out that tulips actually originated in Turkey. They went elsewhere in the world later on. And by them he was revealed as a sensualist beneath his warrior's exterior, a creature of pleasure hiding inside a killer's skin, a female self within the male. He had, too, a woman's taste for finery. When not in battle dress, he lounged in jewels and silks and had a great weakness for exotic furs, the black fox and lynx of Muscovy, which came down to Stamboul through the Crimea. His hair was long and black as evil, and his lips were full and red as blood. Blood and its shedding had been his life's concern. Under Sultan Mehmed II, he had fought a dozen campaigns and won every battle in which he raised his arquebus to the firing position or unsheathed his sword. He had drawn a platoon of loyal Janissaries around him like a shield. With the Swiss giants, Otho, Botho, Clotho, and D'Artagnan, as his lieutenants. And though the Ottoman court was full of intrigues, he had foiled seven assassination attempts. After the Sultan died, the empire came close to civil war between his two sons, Bayezid and Cem. When Argalia learned that the Grand Vizier, in defiance of Muslim tradition, had refused to bury the dead Sultan's body for 3 days, so that Cem could reach Stamboul and seize the throne, he led the Swiss giants to the Vizier's quarters and killed him. He led Bayezid's army against the would-be usurper, his brother, and drove him into exile. Once that was done, he became the new Sultan's commander-in-chief. He fought the Mamluks of Egypt by land and sea, and when he vanquished the alliance of Venice-Hungary and the papacy, his reputation as an admiral equaled his fame as a warrior on dry land. After that, the main problems came from the Shiite peoples of Anatolia. They wore red hats with 12 pleats to show their fondness for 12er Shiism, and as a result, they were attracted to Shah Ismail of Persia, who styled himself the very god. Bayezid's third son, Selim the Grim, wanted to crush them utterly, but his father was more restrained. As a result, Selim the Grim began to think of his father as an appeaser and a weakling. When the goblet from Shah Ismail arrived in Istanbul, that's the goblet I was mentioning, Selim took it as a mortal insult. that heretic who calls himself by God's name ought to be taught his manners, he declared. He picked up the cup as a duelist picks up a glove that has struck him in the face. I will drink Safavid blood from this cup, he promised his father. Argalia stepped forward, and I will pour that wine, he said. When Bayezid refused permission for the war, things changed for Argalia. Basically, the Sultan doesn't want to fight, and so they think he's a weakling, so of course they depose him. The old Sultan was banished into enforced retirement and died of a broken heart on the way, which was just as well. The world has no room for men who have lost their nerve. Salim, with Argalia at his side, hunted down and strangled all his brothers and killed their sons as well. Order was restored, and the risk of a coup eliminated. Then it was time to face Shah Ismail. Argalia and his janissaries were sent to Rum in north-central Anatolia and arrested thousands of residents and slaughtered thousands more. That kept the bastards quiet, while the army marched across their land to deliver Salim the Grim's letter to the Shah. In this letter, Salim said, "You no longer uphold the commandments and prohibitions of the divine law. You have incited your abominable Shiite faction to unsanctified sexual union, and you have shed innocent blood." 100,000 Ottoman soldiers made camp at Lake Van in eastern Anatolia on the way to push these words down Shah Ismail's blasphemous throat. Among their ranks were 12,000 Janissary musketeers under Argalia's command. There were also 500 cannon chained together to form an impassable barrier. The battlefield of Chaldiran was to the northeast of Lake Van, and there the Persian forces made their stand. Shah Ismail's army was only 40,000 men strong, almost all of them cavalrymen, but Argalia, surveying their battle array, knew that superior numbers did not always decide a fight. Like Vlad Dracula in Wallachia, Ismail had used a scorched earth strategy. Anatolia was bare and charred, and the advancing Ottomans marching found little to eat or drink. Salim's army was tired and hungry when it camped by the lake after its long march, and such an army is always beatable. Afterwards, when Argalia was with the princess, she told him why her erstwhile lover had been defeated. "Chivalry," she said, "foolish chivalry, and listening to some stupid nephew of his and not to me." The extraordinary fact is that the enchantress of Persia, along with her slave, the mirror, was present on the command hill above the field of battle. Her thin veiling garment blowing against her face and breasts in the breeze so suggestively that when she stood outside the king's tent, her body's beauty turned the soldier's thoughts entirely away from war. "He must have been mad to bring you," Argalia told her, when blood-filthy and kill-sick he found her abandoned at the death-heavy end of the day. "Yes," she said matter-of-factly, "I drove him mad with love." However, in the matter of military strategy, not even her enchantments could make him heed her. "Look," she cried, "they are still building their defensive fortifications. Attack now when they aren't ready." And, "Look," she cried, "they have 500 cannons chained in a line and 1,200 riflemen behind them. Don't just gallop at them head on or you'll be cut down like fools." And, "Don't you have guns? You know about guns. For pity's sake, why didn't you bring any guns?" To which the Shah's nephew, Dormish Khan the Fool, answered, "It would not be sportsmanlike to attack them when they are not ready to fight. And it would not be noble to send our men to attack them from the rear. And the gun is not a weapon for a man. The gun is for cowards who do not dare to fight at close quarters. Yet however many guns they have, we will take the fight to them until it is hand to hand. Courage will win the day, and not these arquebuses and muskets." She turned to Shah Ismail in a kind of laughing despair. "Tell this man he is an idiot," she commanded him. But Shah Ismail of Persia answered, "I am not a caravan thief to go skulking in the shadows. Whatever is decreed by God's will occur." She refused to watch the battle, sitting instead inside the royal tent with her face turned away from the door. Her slave girl, the mirror, sat beside her and held her hand. Shah Ismail led a charge down the right wing that smashed the Ottoman left, but the enchantress had turned away her face. both armies suffered terrible losses. The Persian cavalry cut down the flower of the Ottoman horsemen, the Illyrians, the Macedonians, the Serbians, the Epirots, Thessalians, and Thracians. On the Safavid side, the commanders fell one by one, and as they died, the enchantress in her tent murmured their names. Muhammad Khan Ustajlu, Hussein Beg Lala Ustajlu, Saru Pira Ustajlu, and so on, as if she could see everything without looking. And the mirror reflected her words so that the names of the dead seemed to echo in the royal tent. Amir Nizamuddin Abdul-Baqi, Al-Baqi. But the name of the Shah, who believed himself to be God, was not spoken. The Ottoman center held, but the Turkish cavalry was on the verge of panic when Argalia ordered the artillery to be brought up. "You bastards," he screamed at his own Janissaries, "if any of you try to run, I'll turn the fucking cannons on you." The Swiss giants, armed to the teeth, ran on foot along the Ottoman battle line to add emphasis to Argalia's threats. Then the thunder of the guns began. "The storm has started," the enchantress said, sitting in her tent. "The storm," the mirror replied. There was no need to look as the Persian army died. It was time to sing a sad song. Shah Ismail was alive, but the day was lost. He had fled the battlefield wounded without coming for her. She knew it. "He is gone," she told the mirror. "Yes, he is gone," the other assented. "We're at the enemy's mercy," the enchantress said. "Mercy," the mirror replied. The men posted outside the tent to guard them had run away as well. They were two women alone upon a field of dreadful blood. That was how Argalia found them, sitting unveiled and straight-backed and alone, facing away from the door of the royal tent at the end of the Battle of Chaldiran, and singing a sad song. The princess Karakoz turned to face him, making no attempt to shield the nakedness of her features from his gaze, and from that moment on they could only see each other and were lost to the rest of the world. He looked like a woman, she thought, like a tall, pale, black-haired woman who had glutted herself on death. How white he was, as white as a mask, upon which, like a bloodstain, those red, red lips. A sword in his right hand and a gun in his left. He was both things, swordsman and shootist, male and female, himself and his shadow as well. She abandoned Shah Ismail as he had abandoned her, and chose again. This pale-faced woman-man. Afterwards, he would claim her and her mirror as spoils of war, and Salim the Grim would agree. But she had chosen him long before, and it was her will that moved everything that followed. "Don't be afraid," he said in Persian. "Nobody in this place knows the meaning of fear," she replied. And beneath those words, the real words, "Will you be mine?" "Yes, I am yours." Well, they go back to Tehran. Not Tehran, Istanbul, to the Topkapi Palace. And, yes, obscene tulips coming. When she undressed Argalia and found tulips embroidered on his underclothes, she understood that he was addicted to his superstitions, that like any man whose work is death, he did what he could to ward off the last day. When she removed his undergarments and found them tattooed on his shoulder blades and buttocks, and even on the thick shaft of his penis, she knew for certain that she had met the love of her life. "You don't need those flowers anymore," she told him, caressing them. "Now you have me instead to be your good luck charm." He thought, "Yes, I have you, but only until I don't. Only until you choose to leave me, as you left your sister, to change horses again as you changed from Shah Ismail to me. A horse is only a horse, after all." She read his mind, and seeing that he needed further reassurances, she clapped her hands. The mirror came into the flower-heavy bedroom. "Tell him who I am," she said. "She is the lady who loves you," the mirror said. "She can charm the snakes from the ground and the birds from the trees and make them fall in love, and she has fallen in love with you. So now you can have anything you desire. The enchantress made a small movement of her eyebrow, and the mirror let her clothes fall to the floor and slipped into the bed. "She is my mirror," the enchantress said. "She is the shadow that shines. Who wins me gets her as well." At this point, Argalia, the great warrior, admitted defeat. In the face of such an outflanking assault, the only course left to a man was unconditional surrender. He was the one who renamed her Angelica. Defeated by Caracos with its glottal stop and unfamiliar progression of sounds, he gave her the name by which her new worlds would know her, and she in turn passed the name on to her mirror. "If I am to be Angelica," she said, "then this guardian angel of mine will be an Angelica too." For many years, he'd had the honor of being permitted as a recipient of the Sultan's favor to reside in chambers in the Abode of Bliss, the Topkapi Palace, instead of the Spartan accommodation at the Janissary Barracks. Now that the chambers had the added grace of a woman's touch, they began to feel like a true home. But home was always a troubled, dangerous idea for men like Argalia to allow themselves to believe in. It could catch at them like a noose. Salim the Grim did not think of him as his indispensable right-hand man, but as a probable and dangerous rival for power. A popular general who could lead his Janissaries into the inner sanctum of the palace, just as he had done once before when he killed the Grand Vizier. A man capable of murdering the Vizier was also capable of regicide. Such a man had perhaps outlived his usefulness. As soon as they were back in Istanbul, the Sultan, while publicly lavishing praise on his Italian commanding officer for his part in the famous victory of Chaldiran, began secretly to plot Argalia's destruction. News of Argalia's precarious position came to his ears on account of Caracos's decision to continue to satisfy his love for tulips. There were gardens all around the Abode of Bliss, walled gardens and sunken gardens, woodland areas where deer wandered freely, and waterside lawns sloping down to the Golden Horn. The tulip beds were to be found in the fourth court, and on the low hill at the northern end of the Topkapi complex, the highest point in the entire Abode of Bliss, where there were small wooden pleasure pavilions called kiosks. The tulips grew around them in great numbers and created an air of fragrant serenity and peace. The Princess Caracos and her mirror, demurely veiled, often walked in these gardens and rested in the kiosks, drinking sweet juices, speaking gently to the many palace bostanchis, the gardeners, to get them to gather flowers for Lord Argalia, and to prattle idly, as women will, about the innocent gossip of the day. Soon all the garden staff, from the lowliest weed puller to the head gardener himself, were deeply enamored of the two ladies, and consequently loose-tongued, as only true lovers are. Many of them remarked how swiftly the two foreign ladies had become proficient in the Turkish language. Almost overnight, or so it seemed. As if by magic, the gardener said. But Caracos's true purposes were far from innocent. She knew, as all new residents of the Abode of Bliss swiftly came to know, that the 1,001 Bostanchis were not only the Sultan's gardeners, but his official executioners as well. This is true, by the way. If a woman was convicted of a crime, it was a Bostanchi who sewed her still alive into a sack weighted down with stones and threw her into the Bosphorus. And if a man was to be killed, a group of gardeners grabbed him and performed an act of ritual strangulation. So Caracos befriended the Bostanchis and learned what they called, with dark humor, the tulip news. And soon enough, the stink of betrayal began to overpower the fragrance of her flowers. The gardeners warned her that her lord, the great general, servant of three sultans, was in danger of being tried on trumped-up charges and sentenced to death. The head gardener himself told her so. The Bostanchi Basha of the Abode of Bliss was the sultan's executioner-in-chief, chosen not only for his horticultural skills, but also for his running speed. Because when a grandee of the court was condemned to death, he was given a chance not granted to common men. If he could outrun the Bostanchi Basha, he could live. His sentence would be commuted to banishment. But the Bostanchi Basha was famous for being able to run like the wind, so the chance was in reality no chance at all. On this occasion, however, the head gardener was not happy about what he would have to do. "To execute such a great man would make me feel ashamed," he said. Then, said the enchantress, "we must find a way out of the situation, if we can." "He will kill you soon," she came home and told Argalia. "The gardens are full of rumor." Argalia said gravely, "On what pretext, I wonder?" The princess took his pale face in her hands. "I am the pretext," she said. "You have taken a Mughal princess as a spoil of war. He did not know that when he gave you leave, but he knows it now. To capture a Mughal princess is an act of war against the Mughal king. And he will say, by placing the Ottoman Empire in such a position, you have committed treason and must pay the price. Such is the news the tulips have to tell." Forewarned, Argalia had time to make plans, and on the day they came for him, he had already sent Karakoz and Hemira under cover of night, along with many treasure chests holding the wealth he had amassed on many successful military campaigns, and protected by the four Swiss giants and the entire company of his most loyal janissaries, some 100 men in all, to wait for him at Bursa to the south of the capital. "If I run away with you," he said, "Salim will hunt us down and murder us like dogs. Instead, I must stand trial. And after that, after I am condemned, I must win the gardener's race." It was what Karakoz had known he would say. "If you are determined to die," she told him, "I suppose I will have to allow it." By which she meant she would have to save his life. And it would be hard, because she would not be present at the scene of the great race. As soon as Salim the Grim, in the throne room of the Abode of Bliss, pronounced the sentence of death on the traitor Argalia, the warrior, knowing the rules, spun on his heel and began to run. From the throne room to the fish house gate, it was about half a mile through the palace gardens, and he had to get there before the Bostanchi Basha in his red skull cap, white muslin breeches and bare chest, who was already in hot pursuit and gaining on him with every stride. If he was caught, he would die at the fish house and be thrown into the Bosphorus, where all the dead bodies went. As he ran between the flower beds, he saw the fish house gate ahead, heard the footsteps of the Bostanchi Basha close behind him, and knew that he could not run fast enough to escape. "Life is absurd," he thought, "to survive so many wars and then be strangled by the gardener." "Truly, it is said, there are no heroes who do not learn the emptiness of heroism before they die." He remembered how, as a young boy, he had first discovered the absurdity of life, abandoned alone in a small rowboat in the middle of a naval battle in a fog. "All these years later," he thought, "I'm having to learn the lesson all over again." No satisfactory explanation was ever given of why Sultan Salim the Grim's fleet-footed head gardener suddenly fell down, clutching his stomach, just 30 paces from the end of the gardener's race, or why he then succumbed to a bout of the foulest farting anyone had ever smelled, releasing blasts of wind as loud as gunshots, and crying out in pain like an uprooted mandrake, while Argalia ran past the finishing post at the fish house gate, mounted the horse waiting for him, and galloped on into exile. "Did you do something?" Argalia asked his beloved when he met her at Bursa. "What could I have done to my dear little Basha?" she answered, wide-eyed. "To send him a message, thanking him in advance for slaying you, my vile abductor, along with a jug of Anatolian wine to demonstrate my gratitude? That is one thing, yes. But to calculate exactly how long a certain potion stirred into the wine would take before it had its effect on his stomach, why, that would be quite impossible, of course." When he looked into her eyes, he saw no sign of any subterfuge there, no indication that she or her mirror or both of them together might have done anything to persuade the gardener to fail in his duty. Perhaps even to take the drink at a time specified in advance, in return for a moment of bliss that would last such a man a lifetime. "No," Argalia told himself, as Karakoz's eyes drew him deeply into their spell. "Nothing of that sort could have happened. Behold the eyes of my beloved. How guileless they are, how full of love and truth." Let's stop there. Nice. Thank you. So obviously they make it to Florence, but then it gets worse. All right. Well, we have microphones there and there, and if you, yes, let's have somebody over here, and maybe somebody over there. Anyone over there? Nobody over there? No. All right. Let's just start with you.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rushdie. That was lovely. You mentioned several times about how unusual the truth tends to be. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the historical types of research you had to do for this novel, or if there were any particular travelers' tales or romances that you were influenced by.
There were lots, but not all of them exactly contemporary with this time period. I mean, for example, about 100 years later than this, about the 17th century, when there was actually more traveling back and forth than there was at this time, there was an Italian traveler called Manucci, who as a young boy, was a 14 or 15-year-old boy, stowed away on a ship and arrived in India just because he wanted to see the world. And he stayed the rest of his life and got various kind of jobs ranging from very small ones to eventually even minor functionary in the court of the Mughal Aurangzeb, who is the three Mughals after Akbar, the last of the six grand Mughals. And he stayed, he lived till a great old age, and he wrote an enormous book, which is called in Italian Storia do Mogor, or the History of the Mughals, in four volumes. And he was a really rotten historian. I mean, almost everything he said was inaccurate to some degree. But what he was a great gossip. You know, so what he was in fact telling you, or what he is in fact telling us down the centuries, is, if you like, the common gossip of how people talked about their times at the time, you know, inaccurate as that was. You know, and I think that's makes it very vivid. You know? And I remember reading this and thinking, because you see, what you need is a writer. It's easy to get the history. You know, what you need is ordinary life. And even more than ordinary life, what you need is how people actually thought, you know, what was happening in their heads. And books like that were very helpful at helping me to get that kind of smell of it. You know, I obviously had to read, I mean, anyone who knows me knows that I am not an expert gardener. So I did have to learn something about gardening. But as you see, it's rather unusual gardening. as I say, there again, something, who would make that up, you know, that somebody's, that the Sultan's gardeners were also his executioners, but that was the case. And even that thing about the gardener's race, that's true. There was a dispensation given to aristocrats, that if they could escape the gardener, they could live, you know. And so it's all this, you don't have to make it up, you see, it's easy. I mean, there was this moment when I was doing the reading when I discovered that at exactly the right time for my purposes, the Ottomans were fighting a war against Dracula, you know. And at the moment when I realized I could have Dracula in the book, you know, I kind of thought I'd gone to heaven, you know. I thought, and again, of course, Dracula was not a vampire. I mean, that's a thing that was made up by Bram Stoker in his novel about Dracula. Also, perhaps less well known, he was not the Prince of Transylvania. And let's say that Romania had two provinces, of which Transylvania is the northern one. He was actually the Prince of the southern province, Wallachia, which is the one which had the common border with the Ottomans, and hence the battles. But actually, he was so bloodthirsty that a little vampirism would have come as light relief, you know, and he was much, much nastier than any vampire has ever been. I mean, actually, he gives vampires a good name by not being one, you know. So, anyway, so Dracula fell into the book. I had to, you know, with great difficulty and fastidiousness, read all these sex manuals, which were very, you know, the Kama Sutra is only one of them. I mean, it's the most famous one, but there actually are two or three very large and detailed manuals for sexual pleasure, which are not all about gymnastic positions, although there are those. Actually, Vatsyayana, the author of the Kama Sutra, was clearly a bird lover. ornithologist, because an enormous number of the recommendations of the Kama Sutra involve making some kind of bird noise. For example, I recall, I will share with you one piece of research. when I say research, I mean reading. there is what the Kama Sutra calls the climbing up the mountain kiss. In order to execute this, the man must stand up. The woman must place her left foot on the man's right foot, her right foot around the man's waist. Place her left arm around his neck, her right arm on his shoulder, incline her head upwards, and make cooing noises. So she is climbing up the mountain, you see, and asking for a kiss. It's all like that. As I say, there's a lot of ornithology. If you're not good at cooing noises, then you're in trouble. So there was all kinds of research from the high to the low. A lot of it had to do with the occult, because this was an age in which people, both in the East and the West, profoundly believed in magic. You know, in a way, there's somewhere in the book, one of the characters says that you know, religion was a thing you could argue about, but magic was a thing you couldn't argue about. You know, that magic was, everybody assumed it was real, and that it existed in daily life. You know, and so I had to learn a lot about that, about witchcraft and so on, and spells, which ranged from the relatively benign to the not so benign. I mean, there was a belief, for example, that hot polenta porridge could cure the plague. That if somebody had the plague and you were to cook a big vat of polenta and you were to cover the sick person's body with hot porridge, that the porridge would kind of suck the illness out of them. And as it cooled down and you removed it, they would get better, allegedly. I wouldn't recommend it as a cure for the bubonic plague myself, but fortunately we don't have to fight that particular disease right now. So there, it was, you know, it was fascinating. I mean, there was just so much of this kind of stuff to learn and then incorporate those bits of it which seemed incorporatable. Yeah, so we have.
Good evening. I wanted to say thanks for being here, and I'm personally a big fan of both the novel and the song, The Ground Beneath Her Feet. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to what it was like to write with U2, and if you still write songs, and how the process for writing a novel differs as to writing a song.
About that, yeah. I didn't write with U2. I wrote the song. they wrote the music. But, I mean, the way it happened very accidentally, because when I had completed the manuscript of the novel, I wanted a few friends of mine who were in the music business to read it to tell me what the mistakes were. You know, and as it happens, I have quite a lot of friends in the music business, and so I sent this manuscript to several of them. And, I mean, because the song with U2 turned out, people think that those were my closest friends, but I've been actually, there's no way of doing this without dropping names, but I've been actually, I have over the years been quite friendly with, you know, Lou Reed and Mark Knopfler and Mick Jagger and quite a lot of, you know, people. And so I used that as the basis for writing the novel, but I then wanted them to tell me if I was being dumb, you know, if things would not really ever have happened like this and so on. So I sent a copy of the manuscript to Bono, and I sent one to the U2 manager, Paul McGuinness, because I wanted him to advise me on the kind of business aspects, you know, et cetera. Anyway, so, and then to my surprise, Bono liked this lyric. You know, he called me up and he said, you know, in your novel, it's the title track. And I said, I wasn't really sure that novels had title tracks, you know, but I said, I know the one you mean. He said, well, I've written a tune, and I think it's quite good. And then he wouldn't play it to me, so I had to go to Dublin. And they had this very rough CD of it. and he was shy, you know, and we had to listen to it. I had to go sit in his car. And he'd play it on the car. I have to say, the car, the sound system in Bono's car is not like the sound system in your car. I mean, in fact, if you open the trunk, it's all sound system. anyway, so we listened to it four or five times, and when he was sure that I actually really liked it and wasn't just saying so, then we played it to other members of the band and so on, and then that's how it happened. I mean, it was a great kick, you know, to have a song. I mean, as far as I know, I'm the only lyricist other than Mr. Hewson that the band's ever had, you know. So there's U2 plus one, you know. I suggested that to them as a possible renaming. And I also suggested Me Too. But they didn't like that. There was one very funny moment where, see, U2, they're so used to doing things the way they do things, you know, and when they record, they just lock themselves away and record, that they forgot to tell me they were recording the track. And I didn't know. The way I found out was that Bono's assistant called me, and she said, "Salman, only you know the lyrics to the song, The Ground Beneath Her Feet Now." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, have you got them?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, they're in the studio. See, Bono's lost them." So she said, "Could you fax them to this number? They'll be right in the studio there today." And I said, "Well, thank you for telling me." You know, that's as close as I got to working with you two. You know, but it was fun. And then there was a moment when the people heard that we'd done this. There was like 5 seconds when half the bands in England thought that it would be really cool to collaborate with me. and so I did get a few requests. The most persistent ones were the band Blur. And they were really keen. I mean, I'd known Damon Albarn a tiny bit. But anyway, Alex James actually was the one who was really keen. And he said, "We have to meet to discuss how we might do this." So I said, "All right." So I went to meet him, and unfortunately, he'd drunk about a gallon of absinthe, which made him slightly less coherent than usual. And he said, "I've had a great idea." He said, "It's great." He said, "I write the words, you write the music." And I said, "Alex, you know, I don't play the guitar." Or the keyboard. He said, I'll teach you. It's fucking easy. It's easy. He said, I'll teach you in 5 minutes. You'll know exactly how to do it. It'll be great. It'll be great. You're right. So that didn't happen. And now there's no more. My moment passed. Yes, over here. Sir.
I'm delighted that you're here. I'm delighted that you're doing what you're doing and what you're writing, and I hope you will live for many, many decades to come.
Yeah, me too.
And I wanted to know, I came here a little bit reluctant because I thought I would go, I'd be checked, and lots of people would make sure that I carry no bombs or anything like that. There was no one to check anything. Does that mean you're off the hook that...
Well, you obviously haven't been here the last 2 times I was here. Otherwise, you'd know that by now. But no, there's been no security issue for almost 10 years now. So yeah, the hook is a long forgotten thing, really. I mean, which is good. yeah, I mean, it went on for, I guess, about 9 years, but it's actually now been over for longer than it went on. You know, so it actually feels like an earlier chapter, more or less. Which is not to say that, I mean, I'm aware of the fact that there are some people amongst the radical Islamic community who still don't like me much. You know, but as it happens, I don't like them. You know, so the feeling is mutual. I think at this stage, it's come down to that. It's come down to kind of name calling, you know, which I can live with, actually. Over here, in the front here.
Salman, can you talk about how your childhood experience and growing up in Kashmir and Bombay influences you today? Are there any particular experiences you had or stories you heard or that influence you even today?
Yes. Thank you. Well, how long have you got? I mean, one thing to say is that in terms of stories, that Kashmir, after all, is the place from which one of the greatest storehouses of Indian tales of wonder ever came, which is the so-called Kathasarit Sagar, or the Ocean of the Streams of Story, a book which is five times the length of the Arabian Nights in Sanskrit and contains some of the most wonderful, fantastic tales, you know, ever created. And if you grow up with that as a part of your heritage, it's a great gift, you know. As indeed, of course, are the Arabian Nights stories, because it's, I mean, what may not be widely known, particularly in the United States, is that if you look at the journey of the stories that ended up being what we now think of as the Arabian Nights, or the Thousand Nights and One Night. Many of these stories began in India, that there were collections of stories in India which made their way into Persia, and they were translated into Persian, where there was a collection called the Hazar Afsana, or the Thousand Tales. The Hazar Afsana became the basis of Arabic translations of the stories, which then became, in many cases, the stories that were contained in the Thousand and One Nights. So it all comes from India, you see. And so if you grow up with that as your literary given, you know, it's liberation, you know. I mean, it's wonderful, because the one thing that it teaches you from the beginning is a thing which we all know as children and we tend to forget as grown-ups, which is that stories are not true. You know, that these things did not happen. Doesn't matter how realistic they are, these people did not live, and these things were not so. I mean, the Arabic phrase that is used instead of the phrase once upon a time translates as it was so, it was not so. And I mean that knife edge, it was so, it was not so in a time long forgotten. Kan makan fi kadima zaman. And that seems to me like the basic contract of the story with its reader. It is so, it is not so. And you grow up knowing that to be true. We all know carpets don't fly, you know, but we also like it that they do. And so it gave me an early lesson in the nature of imaginative truth and the way in which imaginative truth differs from, if you like, reportorial truth. The way in which fiction arrives at truth is not the same way in which journalism does. It's the, you know, the difference between a photograph and a painting. Those kinds of bits of knowledge are useful to grow up with, you know. And my father, I suppose I first heard these stories from my father, who would tell them to us in his versions. And so he gave me all that. My mother gave me an equivalent gift, because my mother was a world-class gossip. I mean, just, you know, if there was an Olympic medal, she would have won it every 4 years forever, you know. She knew, she had in her head this almost infinite web of interconnectedness of all the dirt on everyone. and like all really great gossips, she was unable to keep it to herself. And so I learned just more than I can tell you. And there was a point where she would say to me, I'm not going to tell you any more of this stuff because you just put it in your books, I get in trouble. which was true, of course. And I knew that she would not be able to not tell me, you know, because that was her gift. So I got two different kinds of stories from the two halves of my family, and I think they both stood me in good stead. Thanks. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Somebody at the back, maybe, over there. Yeah. White shirt. We'll have here first. No, we have you first. We'll have you first, and then over there. Okay. the sister.
Of all the cities in the world, what enchanted you about Florence?
Yeah, that's a good, great question. I mean, I went to Florence for the first time when I was 20, and I was still at college. And it was a kind of very strange year to go, because it was just after the Great Flood. And so the city was in a state of very bad disrepair, you know, because the flood had done enormous amounts of damage. And I remember walking into, for instance, the great church of Santa Croce, which has all these huge oil paintings all the way down, and you could literally see a watermark across, where the bottom 2 feet was completely blurred, and the rest of the painting was, you know, intact. And various, I mean, a lot of works of art had been lost, the great Cimabue crucifix, I mean, other things, you know, and I guess for a couple of weeks I did work as what we were known as mud angels. Well, your job was to, you were given a plate and a pair of tweezers, and you had to go looking around in the mud, seeing if you could see a flake of gold paint, and if you could, to pick it up and put it on the tray. And they, and this, I mean, this actually, I mean, I only did it for a short time, but the people who did this relief work actually managed to rescue very substantial numbers of masterpieces in this way. So it was an extraordinary. So I guess I saw the city for the first time in this sort of wounded condition. And it made it even more, I mean, of course, it's still beautiful, you know, but it made it even more moving that it was injured in that way. And I kind of fell in love with it. And because I was a historian I was studying history at Cambridge at the time, it meant that I didn't just fall in love with the paintings and architecture, but I also fell in love with the people of the past. And in particular, the character of Machiavelli, who I always felt was a much more attractive figure than his name has come to mean. And that it was, that I sort of hope that in this book I've managed to do a thing that I wanted to do for a long time, which is kind of rehabilitate Machiavelli. You know? because the point about Machiavelli is that he wasn't Machiavellian. and yet his name has come to stand for, you know, everything that word conjures up. And he was in many ways the opposite of that. I was 20, and that was the beginning of the love affair, and it's gone on. Yes, over here.
Oh, okay, great. That was a little interesting. I guess I sort of have a very specific question, which is, you know, your style is often described as magical realism, but yeah. At the same time you are very deceivingly literate. I was wondering, another author is often described this way, Jorge Luis Borges, and I was wondering if you could talk about the influence that he had on you, maybe.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just to say in general about the term magic realism, I have two problems with it. One is that I think when the term is used, people actually hear magic, they don't hear realism. You know, whereas actually one of the purposes of that way of writing has been not to be escapist, but to be realistic by a different means, which is sort of what I was saying before. So I think in that sense, it has become a kind of misleading term, which is now plastered over more or less any kind of fantasy fiction, you know, and much of which doesn't really conform to what it's supposed to be. I also think that it's a term with value when it talks about when it's used about a particular Latin American literary movement, you know, of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, a movement which, as you say, at the beginning of it, there are figures like Borges and Juan Rulfo, so on, and then you come down through, of course, the great figures of García Márquez and Vargas Llosa and Carlos Fuentes, and so on. And I think it has relevance when it's used about those people, because those people thought that they were doing something together. In the way that the surrealists believed they had a project, you know, I think so did the magical realists of South America. I mean, the term realismo magical, of course, is much older and relates to painting originally. But Borges, I mean, I actually discovered Borges by accident, again, while I was a college student and didn't know anything about Latin American literature at all. I just found a collection of his, the first collection of his stories to be translated, called Fictions, Ficciones, in a shop in Cambridge, and just randomly opened it, you know, and was mesmerized by it, and went away. And I did. García Márquez would say about Juan Rulfo's great novel, Pedro Páramo, that he had memorized it. you know, before he started writing. It's only 90 pages long, sorry, but he memorized it, he said. I mean, the Phithiones, that's also only about 100 pages. I felt that I memorized that at a certain point in my life, and I could recite passages of Funes the Memorious and Circular Ruins and Library of Babel and so on. They're extraordinary, extraordinary short stories because of how much they show you about the possibility of the form. I actually think that Borges's influence on me was more or less malign. I mean, not beneficial, because I think the thing about what he does quite deliberately that was alien to my sensibility, if you like, is that there's no emotion in Borges. You know, it's all in the head, and I mean, it's brilliantly in the head, but it is entirely in the head, and his level of interest in characterization and emotion is very close to zero. You know, so in many ways, this is a very bad exemplar for somebody just starting out to be a writer. Because, truthfully, nobody can write like Borges except Borges. And if anybody else tries to write like that, it's kind of horrible. You know, I mean, there are writers who are so much themselves that you can't learn from them in a way. Like, nobody can write like Hemingway. You know, even Hemingway later on couldn't write like Hemingway. but, you know, the 10 million people who have tried to write like Hemingway, you know, are proof of the fact that you can't. All that, you know, we went to the races and there was wine and it was good. and there were women and the horses won and it was fine. You know, I mean, you know, it's crap, right? Whereas when you read about it in Movable Feast, it's wonderful. You know, so it's that, don't try and do it. And I had to learn how to get away from Borges, really. I mean, I still admire him above most writers, but I had to learn how to shed myself of that influence. Rather, I mean, the American writer who also similarly influenced me badly was Thomas Pynchon. I mean, there was a point when I was young when I was an enormous Pynchonista, you know, and again could quote long passages of V in The Crying of Lot 49 and so on. And again, the trouble with Pynchon is he's so overly infectious that you start writing passages about entropy and, you know, and dropping little strange verses into your text and things like that. And, you know, somebody has to tell you to stop. So influence is not always beneficial. And I mean, some of the writers that you admire most are not, in fact, in the end, helpful to you. You know? But yes, I mean, I loved Borges, still do. Two more questions. Right, one right at the back over there on the right. Yes, gentleman with the T-shirt there, up there. Yeah, you. Yeah, you. Where's the? Have you got the thing? Yeah, there we are. There, right. Wait for the mic. Wait for the mic.
Thank you. Sir Salmon, could you speak, please, a bit about the craft that's involved when you write, where the ideas come from, how much you write per day, how the, you know, chapters are finished, the book is finished, that sort of thing. Thank you.
Ideas come from the idea shop. but we writers don't tell you where it is. you need to be voted into the club and learn a series of secret handshakes and so on, but that's where they come from. I'm telling you the deep secret now. No, it's I wish I knew where they came from. If I knew where they came from, I'd have written a lot more books. You know, I mean, they in my case, it's characteristic that things stick in my head for a long time before I write them. And in fact, the fact of their having stuck in my head is one of the things that makes me notice that I should pay attention to them. I mean, so that, for instance, this business about Florence and Machiavelli and so on, you know, is something I've been thinking about since I was 20 years old. You know, and I finally found a way to tell that story, if you like. So it's that, you know, when I'm not writing, when I don't have a book to write, I'm sitting every day trying to, just kicking ideas around and trying to think of what might be interesting to do. And 95% of that material the next day comes to seem not that interesting, you know. Some of the stuff continues to seem interesting. And gradually, out of that process, I find myself thinking, oh, well, here's what I appear to be interested in, and then I have to work out why I'm interested in it. So it's a journey from unconscious to conscious is what I'm saying, and I'm not exactly sure how it takes place, but it takes place by paying attention, really. And then writing is, I don't know, there's no rule about writing either. I mean, there have been books where I've written from page one to the end. There have been other books where I've written out of sequence and then had to piece it together. And there have been books where I've been completely clear about the narrative line all the way, and there have been others in which I've had to discover it as I went. And so there's, I mean, the only rule is that it's different each time. You know, and it seems as if each book arrives in a different, in the way that it needs to arrive. You know, and sometimes you start off with a character, and sometimes you actually do know something about the plot, and sometimes it's just a few sentences. I mean, Joseph Heller used to say that it always started with sentences for him. That he used to think of sentences and be aware that those sentences immediately led to several hundred more sentences. You know, in the office in which I work, there are six people of whom I'm afraid. You know, so it's now the beginning of chapter two of Something Happened, which was originally the beginning of the novel. You know, the moment he saw the chaplain, Yossarian fell in love with him. The beginning of Catch 22. So and I have sometimes had that experience that you just write down a sentence and you realize that you now know the next 100 sentences that follow from that sentence. There's no rule. It's not tidy. It's messy. There are tidy writers. Fitzgerald was a very tidy writer. You know, Fitzgerald was a writer who really worked out in immense detail what he wanted to write, I mean, almost down to paragraph by paragraph, and had very detailed architectural plans, notes of the book. And by the time he got round to writing, he was essentially just writing, filling in the skeleton that he'd already created. Calvino was a writer like that. I mean, Calvino was remarkable in that he could work on half a dozen different projects at the same time and was able to keep them absolutely clear in his mind just decide that today he would work on this one, tomorrow he'd work on that one. But that's a kind of intellectual clarity and rigor and discipline that I don't have. So I do it the messy way. Now, you've got one more question. Let's see over here. You've been holding your arm up a long time. Yeah, over here. Yeah. Make it a good one. No pressure.
There's a book called The Tower of Babel that deals with the riddle of translation. And I guess my question to you is, A, have you ever read your books in languages other than English? And when you read them, do you find that they're not the book that you wrote? And if they're not the book that you wrote, is there the sense that ideas and thoughts have a life of their own, that once you've written them in one language, they permutate and change and you can't really contain them?
Well, that's really true, I think. I mean, the only languages in which I can read other than English is, I mean, the best one is French. I mean, my Italian is all right, but it's not enough to judge a translation, even a translation of my own book. And yes, it is different. I mean, because the range of cultural reference available in one language is not the same in another language. And if you refer to a poem in English, which you would have a pretty high expectation if it's by, let's say, Shakespeare, that your readers might be familiar with the particular verse that you're referring to, a French reader would not necessarily be able to have that. I've had cases in which a French translator has substituted a line of Mallarmé instead of a line of Shakespeare, you know, and I think that's reasonable, because you know, you need to essentially create the right cultural echo in the mind of the reader. I mean, I just think translation is the most underrated art form of all the art forms, And any of us who, first of all, you know, writing in the English language, it's such a, in a way, unfair privilege because of the power of the English language in the world, how many people read it. You can you forget that for many people in the world, the only access they have to the literatures of other countries is through the translator. And now that my books get translated into these ludicrous numbers of languages, I mean, I come to value what the translator brings to the table, you know, more and more and more, because it's my books are not easy to translate, you know, and so it requires a really quite remarkable and I think genuinely creative act. You know, it's an act of interpretation to take it across the language frontier. I mean, there are writers who worry about, Ishiguro, for example, Kazuo Ishiguro, a friend of mine, has this theory. He's given to theories. He has this theory that in the age of when we are translated into many languages, it becomes our duty to write in a way that makes our text easy to translate. I mean, i.e. to write in a very plain, easy style, which any translator can easily render into another language. This is a kind of transcultural courtesy. And I've heard him expound this theory at some length, actually. But he has, and I don't go along with it, really. I think I'll do my job, you do yours. he has another theory. His other great theory is that it was a wonderful idea, actually. He wanted to find out how old the great writers of world literature were when they wrote their greatest books. How old was Flaubert when he wrote Madame Bovary? How old was Tolstoy when he wrote Anna Karenina? How, etc. And so, being very, very methodical, he studied all this and reported back that basically, if you hadn't done it by the time you were 35, you were really in trouble. And if you hadn't done it by the time you were 40, you were essentially screwed. And if you hadn't done it by the time you were 50, you should really just stop. You know? And there are exceptions to this, of course. There are famous writers who are late starters, like Conrad, others. But on the whole, he fairly categorically proved that great literature is written by young writers. And that the peak appears to be around that 35 to 40... 35 more than 40, actually, which to those of us who just turned 61 is... It doesn't cheer one up, you know. And so you begin to look for the exceptions, you know. You begin to look at it. So, anyway, thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.